All right, everyone, welcome to our ninth and final lecture. So today we're going to be learning about programming. So last week we just had a lecture video posted. So that is on the course website, so check out that lecture if you want to learn about HTML and CSS, and if you haven't seen it already. That week's problem set is not due today, it's due later in the week on Thursday, just you know to kind of make up for the fact that we didn't hold class on Monday. So also on the course website is some more formal specifications for the course's final project. So we mentioned in a previous previous problem set that you'd basically be making a website kind of devoted to a topic of your choosing for the final project. So we had you brainstorm a couple ideas, and so we get feedback on those pretty soon. And so this, now on the course website, we just have kind of a longer list of things that you can do for your final project, and if you want to put your website online, kind of some instructions on how to do that. So how to register a domain name and how to upload things to a web host. Not only do we cover this in lecture, we also have section videos dedicated just to these two things. So definitely feel free to consult those if you're really excited to put your website online. If you don't want to pay for a domain name and pay for hosting, that's totally okay. That's not required for the final project, but we do recommend it so that you can kind of show off your website to the world since it's going to be really cool. So some other administrivia. So back in PSET 5, we promised that you would make some image and then we'd be able to put that image somewhere on a store where you could buy it. So now if you go to cse1.net/store, you'll see something like this. So we've just started uploading some of the images, so they're not all there yet. But just to give you a sense of what we can do, so here is just the Computer Science 1 logo on t-shirts, on sweatshirts, on mugs. This actually came out pretty nice, I think. Some water bottles and all these kind of things. So all the images that you made for PSET 5 will soon be up in the E1 store. If you'd like to just browse the images, there's also a link on the course website now, just kind of all of the images that you all created for PSET 5. I just wanted to go through a couple of my favorite ones. So I thought this was super cute. Some grumpy cat. This was very much appreciated. This is the lazy college senior meme with whom I'm sure we can all relate. Then there were some really cool logos. Someone appreciating the other thing that's not a cat. Back to cats. This is also really, really cool. I like this a lot. This was Ben's favorite. So yeah, so feel free to browse the gallery. And everyone did some really, really awesome images for PSET 5. And so feel free to browse those and see what your classmates did. And if you want, put it on a t-shirt. So last week, we covered HTML. And so if you haven't checked out the video yet, definitely do so. So we posted lots of examples of HTML, and we looked at some kind of different frameworks like Bootstrap and Flat UI and kind of how to make a website look really nice. We're also tonight going to be posting some recaps for that. So originally, we didn't have recaps available by now, so we went and we did them anyway since we had some requests for recaps in addition to all these examples. So we have some abbreviated recaps for HTML and CSS, so feel free to refer to those as you're working on your problem set. But basically, last week, when we looked at HTML, HTML was not a programming language, right? The ML in HTML is markup language. So does anyone happen to know the difference between a markup language and a programming language? Kind of like, what might the difference be? You know, if you've used HTML, what was something you couldn't do? So let's say that we're trying to write some application for our computer. Like, let's say I wanted to write down and make Google Chrome or make Microsoft Word. Could I do that using just HTML? No, so why not? What can't I do with HTML?
Search or query.
Yeah, exactly. So I can't do things like search or query or perform some kind of logic, right? So HTML is just a way of describing the structure of our document. We said, here's a heading, here's a paragraph, here's an image. But that's really all it did. It didn't really give us any way of interacting with anything on the page or giving us some way of performing logic to do things like respond to users' clicks or make things fly around the page. So similarly, CSS didn't really give us that either. So CSS still isn't a programming language. All this thing did was give us some way of putting some aesthetic style on their HTML, which again is just some document, and we're representing that document hierarchically with tags and things like that. So today, we're going to look at programming languages. And we'll see what programming languages allow us to do is create these instructions to give our computer that we can execute logically and actually do something, rather than just kind of represent information using this markup language. We'll be able to do something and respond to what other people are doing with our programs. So the first thing that we need to talk about is this scary word here called algorithms. And so we've actually mentioned this a few times throughout the semester. We've already seen a few different algorithms. So does anyone can anyone give this a definition? What is an algorithm? Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So an algorithm is kind of a flow of logic. So does anyone else want to add on to that? So that's a great start. Yeah. Yeah, so a set of instructions. So we have some logical flow of instructions. We're going to somehow give that to a computer, and it's going to do something. So anyone else want to add to our definition of algorithm? Yeah. So many formulas are also algorithms. You know, you might have a few-step process for something like adding numbers or finding, you know, the least common denominator or something. So anyone else have any thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, so that's a great way of thinking about it. So kind of like a recipe. You know, a recipe has these different steps. And if we follow all these steps correctly, then we'll get something kind of as a result of us doing this all at the end. So something like baking a cake, you know, we kind of have a cake baking algorithm, for example. So yeah, so that's another great way of thinking about it. So let's take a look at this question here. So this is a question that we posed at the end of the first lecture. We kind of proposed a very simple algorithm for solving this problem. So this algorithm is just this really concise process for getting some answer to the question. And so the algorithm we proposed was this. Because we figured, you know, if we're in a movie theater and there are a bunch of people and everyone wants to know what chair they're sitting in, because, you know, Oprah just gave away a car to someone sitting in one of these chairs. So if everyone needs to know what chair they're sitting in, it's kind of a waste of time for all of us to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, we all have to do this at the same time. We're all really solving the same problem. And so here's an algorithm that we proposed to solve this problem a little bit more efficiently. So we said, okay, we want to, rather than counting myself, all I'm going to do is I'm going to turn to my left, and I'm going to ask that person where they are sitting. Now this person may or may not have an answer, right? And if they don't have an answer, then they're going to kind of palm this question off to the person to their left. So basically we have this whole chain that goes down until eventually we reach someone at the end of the row. And that person could just say one. And then the person to their right, who originally asked them, what seat are you, can now know, oh, well, if they're seat one, I must be seat two. This can kind of propagate back up, and we just solve this problem kind of in a more efficient way than everyone sitting there and counting themselves. And so this can be considered an algorithm, right? We have these three steps, and each of these steps is pretty well defined, right? They're very concise and precise, and, you know, if you're a person following this algorithm, you kind of know what to do. There's not a whole lot of guesswork or even flexibility, really. And so this is kind of what we mean when we look at an algorithm. We have this formal specification of what to do in order to solve some problem or to make something or to get something. So let's try a different algorithm. So now we have this question here. How many people are in the room? So if I'm standing here and I want to try to solve this problem, the most natural thing to do would say 1, 2, 3, 4, and kind of count everybody. And this, you know, might take a while if there are a lot of people here, which of course there are because everyone goes to E1 lecture. But at the end of the day, the more people that are in the room, the longer it's going to take me to solve this problem, right? Because I have to count rather than from 1 to 10, from 1 to 100, and it's just going to take me longer. And so if we look at kind of a graph of how long it's going to take me to solve this problem, it looks something like this. So as the number of people in the room goes up, kind of the time it takes me to solve it goes up like this line here, right? Because for every additional person, that's one more step I have to take to solve the problem, because I need to count everyone. So how might I speed this up? What's kind of a natural thing you learn to do in grade school when you want to speed up this kind of counting problem? Yeah? Yeah, exactly. So I might want to do something like count by two. So rather than saying 1, 2, 3, 4, I can say, you know, 2, 4. And that just took me about half the time. And so now, you know, as the size of the room gets bigger, you know, suddenly I can solve the problem a little bit faster. You know, it used to take me something like 100 steps. Now it's going to take me instead 50 steps. And so, you know, at first that sounds nice, right? It took me half the time. This is really cool. But still, we kind of have this line here. And it looks like as the size of the problem gets bigger, we're not really doing too well. right? You know, if there's still 1,000 people in the room, it's still going to take me a really long time to solve that problem. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to try a different algorithm that solves this problem much faster. And so we're actually going to do this right now. We're going to figure out how many people are here. And this is the algorithm that we're going to use. So if everyone wants to follow step one, which is stand up. Okay, so now that everyone is standing, what we're going to do is we're going to count each other. So our algorithm looks something like this. Everyone stands up, and you're going to think of the number one. You are number one, you're the best. So then you're going to pair off with someone else who is standing. So then you're going to add two of your numbers together, and the sum of those numbers is your new number. So then one person in this pair is going to sit down, and the next person is going to back up. So let's just have RJ and Ben demo this. So RJ and Ben, you're both number one.
You're number two. Well, I'm number two, and he sits
down. Okay. So now Ben's set. So if everyone wants to try to execute this algorithm, and we'll see how far we get. Yeah, so keep going until eventually there'll be, you know, one person standing. So what do we end up with?
I totally understand.
I was number four.
Yes. Right. I was three originally.
You're seven, I was five, and I was 12.
Okay. All right.
12.
20, that sounds about right. Okay. So awesome job. So this is so great job. And so now, you know, in practice with people, this might have been a little bit slower than me sitting here and counting by fives. I think, yeah, if someone wants to count and verify, we're probably like 18 or 20-ish. So this was actually a much more efficient way of solving the problem. So can anyone kind of describe why this ended up, you know, if everyone were to do this, you know, as fast as it would take me to go 1, 2, 3, why would this approach be faster? What are we doing that makes it faster? Yeah.
Distributing the amount of calculations so coming to an answer much faster.
Yeah, exactly. So now rather than, you know, me sitting here and going 1, 2, 3, we're kind of distributing it out. So what else? Yeah. Exactly. So now that we're multitasking, what we're actually kind of doing is we're cutting the problem in half because we're allowing everyone to multitask and work at the same time. So after our first run, you know, we had about 20 people standing. So after, you know, this algorithm executed once, how many people did we have standing? Yeah, so we had 10 standing, right? Because everyone paired off and someone sat down. So that means that half of the people in the room sat down. So then we went from 10 to 5 and then, you know, somehow awkwardly down to 2 and 1 with, you know, rounding. And so eventually, though, our graph is going to look very, very different, right? So now let's say if we had, you know, something like 100 people in the room, how long would it take to solve this problem?
5, 10, 12.
Yeah, so it's going to take, so now we can go from 100 to 50 to 25 to 12 to 6 to 3 to, you know, roughly 8 or 9 steps, right? Now, counting by twos, that would have taken 50 steps, and I'd kind of have to count by, like, you know, 20s or 10s in order to actually get the same amount of steps. So if you look at that graph, this process of cutting the problem in half every single time looks like this. And so this is much, much nicer. And so from math class, it turns out that, you know, we can use a logarithm, you know, to determine how many times, you know, we can cut the problem in half before we reach the solution. You don't have to worry about too much to what the logarithm means, but basically this curve is very, very, very different. So as the size of the problem is increasing, the time it takes us to solve that problem is not actually increasing that much at all. So if we compare, you know, 100 and 200 and 300, it's really not going to take us that many more steps to count 300 people versus 200 people. Where if you look at these lines over to the right, adding another 100 people is going to be devastating as far as their runtime is concerned. So any questions on, you know, how this approach solves the problem much more efficiently? Okay, yeah. Yes. So the difference between algorithm and logarithm. So these are unfortunately very similar words. So we said before, you know, an algorithm is just some kind of recipe for solving a problem, some step-by-step process that gives us some output. And a logarithm is just some kind of mathematical operation. And in this case, we're saying the log of some number is basically how many times we can cut that in half until we can't cut it in half anymore. So we cut down to one. And this is just kind of, if you graph a logarithm, what that looks like. You know, the takeaway here is just that kind of by taking the problem and cutting it in half each time can give us a much faster runtime. We can solve the problem much more efficiently. Okay, so let's try another algorithm. And this one is probably the easiest question I will ever ask. How do you make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? So together, let's come up with an algorithm for making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So I'm going to switch over so I can write. So let's try to shoot for, you know, three or four steps or so. So what's the first step in my algorithm? Get two slices of bread. Okay. Well, which one is it? Okay, so get two slices. Okay. My handwriting's terrible. What's step two? Yeah, okay, so let's get a knife. Making forward progress. Step three. All right, so let's say like knife, some peanut butter, and jelly, and just kind of combine that all into one. Okay, so let's say we have all our supplies. What's the next step? Just to kind of limit.
Assemble.
Okay, so let's break it down, assemble into little more steps. Okay, great. So let's say peanut butter. Yeah, okay. So there's potentially a problem. So let's write that first. So let's say, you know, put the knife in the jar. That's a J apparently. Spread.
Where are we
getting a bar from? Yeah, that's a J today. All right. Spread peanut butter and jelly. Stick him like a J on bread. Okay, that's not a five either. So what's the next step? Next step in our algorithm? All right, so let's place them together. Okay, so this looks like a pretty nice algorithm for coming up and making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So can I have two volunteers to actually execute this algorithm? Yeah, so one. RJ, definitely. Yeah, one. And another one? Oh, yeah, we're really going to do it. Yeah, so go ahead. Okay. Yeah. One, two, three. We're good. Yeah, so we have RJ and then two volunteers. RJ doesn't count. Okay, just, you know. We didn't need that. Okay. So if you want to come around to the table. So I have a number of supplies here, and we're going to see how robust our algorithm is. So we have a loaf of bread, we have peanut butter, we have a knife, and a spoon. This can be bread. We have that jelly and that jelly. And let's just open this up. This loaf of bread has a bag in a bag. Okay. Okay, so let's give. Okay, so what's your name again?
Tiffany.
Tiffany. So let's give Tiffany two slices of bread, and let's give RJ a bag. Okay. Okay, so we have peanut butter there, one there. Okay, let me just get this out of the way. Okay, so let's see how well our algorithm is actually going to perform. So before we start yet, so we're just going to do these steps exactly as they appear. You know, we're not going to have any liberties. We're just a computer, and we're blindly going to execute whatever steps that we are given. So here we go. So step one, get 2 slices of bread. Okay, RJ has a bag. Step 2, get a knife. RJ, oh, you got a knife.
Yeah.
Okay, so step 3, put knife in jar. You got it in. All right, so okay, so step 4 now is spread the peanut butter on the bread. All right, and we'll kind of, just for handwriting's sake, let's say that, you know, we're going to jump back to step 3, and we're going to put our knife in our other jar, which is not so relevant for the squirting jelly. And so then we'll spread the jelly on the bread. And so finally, in step 5, we can put them together. So there we go. So great job to our volunteers executing this algorithm and getting a sandwich. That's really clever.
That's great.
Can we sit down?
Yeah, you're all set. Thank you so much. Okay, so it looks like in some cases our algorithm performed pretty well. So we got a sandwich, kind of one sandwich on the right, got a different kind of sandwich in the middle, and then we got RJ on the left. So what happened? Describe kind of what happened with this algorithm when we kind of threw some inputs at it that, you know, we might not have anticipated. What happened? Yeah.
It has been defined, you know, what the jar would be, or, you know, like in the case of our dad, the jar wasn't open, so perhaps opening the jar might have been one step.
Yeah, so basically this algorithm was nice. We're kind of missing a few key steps, right? As a computer, if you just tell me to kind of spread peanut butter and jelly on bread, you know, that's a really big process, and I don't really know how to do that. So when we write these algorithms, what we really need to do is break this down into really, really small pieces and be really, really specific with the pieces that we break them down into. So something like put the knife in a jar, it seems, you know, that, okay, that makes sense, but that's not really specific enough, because RJ's going to stick, he's eating a sandwich now. So I guess RJ can actually stick the knife literally in the jar because we didn't kind of formalize our algorithm enough. So anything else? So kind of what happened with our algorithm when we gave it some other inputs? Anything else?
It's almost like the 5 steps became more work than they should have.
Yeah, exactly. So
you get 2 slices of bread, get a knife in jar. So the algorithm became, each one became more of a problem than actually solving it because of those 5 steps. So much work computer-wise. You know what I mean? Just the 5 steps just seem to make it more work to me, the way it's laid out.
Yeah, so even though we might guess, okay, well, you know, a 5-step algorithm is going to be easier to execute than a 20-step algorithm, you know, that might not necessarily be the case. So we ended up kind of putting a lot of work on ourselves because these steps weren't specific enough. So as you know, we're starting to write our own computer programs and make computers do things. We need to be sure that we really are specific in what we tell our computer to do. When we're thinking about solving these problems, really try to break them down into really basic algorithmic steps rather than just kind of, you know, saying, computer, go solve a problem. And this is kind of what we're going to need to do, you know, as we move forward and start designing computer programs. We're going to need to come up with algorithms that are more specific than something like this. Because even though, you know, RJ could figure out, you know, okay, I have, you know, a squirt jelly, I'm not supposed to put my knife in that, your computer isn't going to be able to make that kind of human judgment call. So let's jump back here. Okay. So let's start actually writing some computer programs. So we're going to start off in a programming language called Scratch. And so this is a really cool program that was developed by MIT. So if we head to scratch.mit.edu, we'll see something like this. So Scratch is really, really nice because we don't actually have to type out, you know, the instructions for our program. We can actually drag and drop puzzle pieces into place to create some kind of logical flows inside of our program. So if the problem set, you'll be asked to do this. So scratch.mit.edu is the website here. And this is what Scratch actually looks like. So you can see here that on our right, this is where our program is actually going to be executed. So you know we already have nice things like a cat, what else? And he's kind of sitting in a world. And we're going to be able to learn how to make this cat do kind of our bidding. So there are a few components to Scratch to talk about. So that cat character on the right is something called a sprite. So if you've ever played video games before, you may have heard this term sprite. This is basically just kind of the name for some character or some image on the screen. So you consider that cat is a sprite, and we can make our sprites move around and change their appearance and things like that. Now that sprite is sitting on something called a scene, or Scratch calls it a stage. And we can also, you know, manipulate the stage to make it have a different background and make the stage do things as well. And attached to these sprite things are these other things called scripts. And a script is kind of the meat of where our Scratch program. So just like we specified some recipe for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, these scripts are going to be these logical flows that we want our sprites to actually execute. And these scripts are actually going to make our characters do things. So let's take a look at a really, really simple Scratch program. So over here on the left, we can see here we have a number of puzzle pieces that we can kind of drag into this area on the right to make these scripts and things that will be executed. So the first block that I'm looking for is this thing here, when green flag clicked. And so I'm just going to take that and I'm going to drag it anywhere I want over here to the right. So this when green flag clicked is kind of the entry point for our program. So what we're saying is, OK, when I'm a user and I want to run our program, I'm going to come over here, I'm going to click on this green flag. What this is going to do is it's going to kick off all of the scripts that we've put inside of our Scratch program. So if we just had random puzzle pieces sitting over here on the right side, nothing's going to really happen because they're just going to be sitting out there in a void and they won't be run. So this when green flag clicked is how we want to actually start off our script. So let's create some kind of logical flow. So I want to say after this green flag is clicked, let's come over here on the left to looks. And scroll down and say hello. So I'm going to click on this, and I'm going to drag and drop it in. And notice here how this say hello kind of nicely fits into the puzzle piece when green flag clicked. That's because this makes sense. We're going to create some logical flow. And the flow says after you click the green flag, then I want you to say hello. And that's it. That's our entire program. It's going to be really, really simple. So if we come over here now to the right side, and we click on this green flag, we get this. Our cat says hello. And so this is kind of our first program, our simplest program that we'll see today. And it's just kind of one step. Once the user clicks on the green flag, I want you to say hello. So if we want to say something else rather than hello, so if we want to say something like hello RJ, we could just double click inside of this say thing here. And I can start typing. And now when I come back over here, I click the green flag, the cat will say something else. So any questions on kind of the basic setup of Scratch? OK. So let's write some more interesting programs. So what we just did is we inserted one statement into our program. So a statement is basically saying, I'm going to do something. So one thing that we can do is make our cat say hello. So that say hello is one form of a statement. So another statement might be something like this. So if we want our cat to say hello and then wait a second before doing anything else, another statement would be something like wait 1 second. And so let's see what happens when we do that. So if we jump back here. So let's say we want to say hello, RJ. We can stop this program. Then we want to say hello to Ben. So what I might do is I might come up here to control, click on that. Then I'm going to take this wait 1 second and drag it over. And again, notice how it nicely snaps into place because this makes sense for statements to come one after another. Then I'll come back up to here to looks and drag and drop say, double click this, and say hello, Ben. And so now when we run this program, actually, let's use a different block. Rather than just say, let's say I want to save for a couple seconds. So if I want to get rid of this block, we can just drag this back over to the left and get rid of it. So I'm going to say hello, RJ. I'm going to come back up here to control. I'm going to say wait 1 second. Come back over here. And I'm going to say hello to Ben. So now if I click on the green flag, we get hello RJ, wait 1 second, and then say hello Ben. So again, this is just a series of statements, one after another. We're not really doing any additional logic here. So another statement might be this one here. So we can also, Scratch has the ability to play sounds, which is really, really nice. So if I open up a Scratch program, hello 3, we'll scratch that. So now, what I've done here is I've come over here to sound, and Scratch has a bunch of sounds built in, so have fun playing all of those really loudly while people are trying to do things. Now, if we run this, look at something that's pretty annoying. And so this play sound is just a different type of statement. So again, notice how all these blocks just kind of look the same. There's just one slot before it, and there's one slot after it. So the statement is just kind of one step in a process. So we could, you know, keep this going with a bunch of statements that are in just kind of linear flow, but a lot of times we might want to do that. Instead, we want to kind of branch off depending on the current state of the world. So for example, if you're reading something like a Choose Your Own Adventure novel, I used to love those. They're like Indiana Jones ones or Encyclopedia Brown, if you ever read those. So in a Choose Your Own Adventure novel, what happens is you'll be reading, and eventually you'll hit a page, and you'll have to make some kind of decision. You know, if you want to go, you know, look in the closet, then turn to page 100. If you want to go back downstairs, then turn to page 120, or something like that. And so that kind of branching point means that we can do something different depending on the state of the world. Right? If I think going back downstairs is a good idea, then I can take some action, or if no, I don't think that's a good idea, I can take some other action. So we have the same idea in our programs. We can say, okay, if something is true, if some fact about the world is true, then I want to go and do this. And if that thing isn't true, then I want to go over here and do this. And so suddenly our kind of linear flow of statements becomes much more complicated because we can have all these branching and kind of create this complicated flow to create more complex programs. So what are the kind of questions about the state of the world that Scratch allows us to ask? So we have things like, you know, if an object is touching the mouse pointer, then if that's true, then we can do something. If that's not true, we can do something else. Similarly, we can say, well, is the user's mouse down? If the user is clicking on something, we can do something. If not, we can do something else. And all of these things are called Boolean expressions. When we say Boolean expression, we just mean something that is either true or false. Right? With our mouse, it is either down or it is not down. Or similarly, we are either touching the cat with our pointer or we are not touching the cat with our pointer. So when you see the word Boolean, that just means something that's either true or false, so kind of like a 0 or a 1 in binary. Can't be anything else but those two states. So we can also kind of combine these expressions together. So in Scratch, you know, we might want to say, you know, if you know this is less than this, and inside of this left-hand side, we can actually put a more complicated expression. So instead of saying something like if 1 is less than 2, we could say something like if 1 is less than 2 and 2 is less than 3. Or, you know, more realistically, if the user's mouse is down and they're touching a cat, that could mean something like they've clicked on it. Then we can act on that state of the world. So we can also say, you know, if this is true or this is true, and that's just another way of combining these Boolean expressions together. So now that we have these questions, you know, let's take a look at how to actually create that branching off into different states of the world. So this kind of branching thing is called conditions. I'm going to say if some condition, some Boolean expression, is true, whether that Boolean expression be this and this or this and this, you know, regardless of what that is, if it's true, then I want to do something. If it's not true, then I want to do something else. And so in Scratch, this condition looks something like this. And so you'll notice that the shape here looks exactly like the shape of the Boolean expressions we just saw, this kind of hexagonal thing. So now, when we say if this condition is true, inside of here, we can start filling in some things to do if something's true. And if that's not true, then we can start filling some things in down below. So let's take a look at an example. So if we come back to the laptop. So this was our program before. Let's change this a little bit. So let's add in a condition. So we're going to come up here to control. We're going to scroll down a bit until we see this thing here. So let's just say if, let me zoom out. I'm going to drag in this if, and notice how it still fits. And so let's come up with a condition. So if I come up here to the top left and click on operators, I'm just going to randomly pick this less than 1. And let's just pick something that's definitely going to be true. So if 1 is less than 2, if it's not, then we have bigger things to worry about. So if this is true, let's come back over here to sound, and let's drag and drop this inside. And so now we have a little bit more complex of a program. We're going to say, OK, if this thing is true, we're going to play the sound. And if not, then nothing is going to happen. So if I click this green flag, what should happen? Yeah, so the cat's going to meow. So now let's say that I change my expression here. What if I say 2 is less than 1? Now it's going to happen. Yeah, so nothing's going to happen. We're going to say anticlimactic. We're going to come over here, and our program is going to say, OK, step 1, check if this is true. This is not true, so I'm going to skip over this. And then that's kind of the end of my program. So let's try making this a little bit more interesting. So we know that, you know, 1 is always going to be less than 2, and 2 is always going to be more than 1. So let's try doing something like, let's pick a random number. And if that random number is less than some other number, then we're going to try to do something. And so what this does is this allows us to simulate like flipping a coin. And if this coin is heads, then I want the cat to meow. And if it's not, then I don't want the cat to do anything. So let's try that. So we definitely want to start off with that if thing. So let's come back down here, say if. Let me zoom out. OK, so now we're looking for this thing here, this random number. But it looks like this thing here is a circle. And it doesn't really make sense to say if random number. So we can't just plug in this random number thing into the condition in our if. Scratch will say, nope, can't do that. So let's come back here and look for this piece here, since we know, you know, that this is going to fit in. OK, so let's pick a random number. We can actually slide this right inside there. So our program now is going to do, it's just going to pick a random number. We can say, OK, well, let's say that it's less than 6, since that's kind of halfway. And so now, if we come up here to sound and just drag that same thing in, so now what's going to happen when I click the green flag? Is the cat going to meow or not? Yeah, so it's going to depend. So if we pick a random number between 1 and 5, then it will. And if not, then we won't. So if we click the green flag, OK, we picked a small number. Again. OK, there we go. So that time we picked a number that's greater than 6. And so we can see here that by introducing randomness, now our programs get to be more interesting. We don't know that the same thing is going to happen every single time the user plays. Right? If we're making a game, then if we started our game off and everything was exactly the same every time our game started, then it's going to get really boring and it's going to get easy to beat. So by introducing things like randomness, we can change what the state of the world looks like so that it makes things more interesting for the user. And so really, when we introduce this kind of randomness, all this really boils down to is taking some random number generator. You know, your computer doesn't actually have the ability to generate random numbers. So this is kind of pseudo-random, kind of close enough to random. And then based on what that value is, we can do something. So we can also nest these if-elses inside of each other. So we can say, okay, if this is true, then do this, and kind of create this three-way branch, where before we only had this two-way branch. So you can go as deep as you want with nesting these conditions inside of each other. So that was nice, but let's take a look at something called loops. So earlier in our example, we had our cat meow three times. And in order to do that, I kind of had to go over to the left and say, play the sound, wait, play the sound, wait, play the sound. That's going to get really tedious if I want the cat to do something like 100 times, for example. So we have this construct in programming and in Scratch called loops. And a loop basically allows some block of code or some set of puzzle pieces to be executed over and over and over again. So that means rather than copy-pasting this meow and wait three times, I can put this single block inside of a loop and say execute this loop three times. So the most basic kind of loop is just this one here. It says forever. This means that forever, I want you to keep doing something over and over again. So let's jump back to the laptop and throw in a forever loop here. So we can take this whole thing, throw it away, slowly. So we come up to control, we scroll down, we see this forever. And so now let's put in a sound. And so now what's going to happen when I click the green flag? Yeah, so we're going to meow. That's annoying. So that might not be what we want. So how can we fix this? So, you know, rather than meowing over and over again, how can we kind of slow down the rate at which the cat is meowing? What block have we seen that we can put in here? Yeah, so that wait 1 second, exactly. So if we come over here to control, if we drag in wait 1 second, slightly more sane, but still extremely annoying. So, but the basic idea here is that this loop is going to keep going over and over again. Even though we only have one meow block, we're getting our cat to meow a bunch of times. So if we don't want something to happen forever, what we can do is we can define some condition at which it's not going to happen anymore. And so this is kind of what might be more common as you're creating loops in your program. So we don't want to just repeat forever, for example. Now, let's say we only want to repeat three times. So what we're really doing here under the hood is we're saying, I want to define some Boolean expression that represents a condition for which I'm no longer going to do something. So our condition is, once I've run this three times, I want you to stop. And so that's how we can create some loop without inducing this foreverness into our program. So that forever is something called an infinite loop, because it's going to loop forever. And that's not always the best thing in the world. So let's try to make some. Let's try to build a simple program together. So what I'd like to do is I'd like this cat to sit here, and I want to kind of create the simulation of petting the cat. So if the cat is sitting here and my mouse is over here, then nothing's going to happen. But as soon as I take my mouse and I put it on top of the cat, I want it to meow. So what are some constructs we can use to achieve this? So what might my approach be to creating this program? Yeah? Yeah, exactly. So let's start with a condition of some sort. So let's go over here to our if. So we're going to say if. Then we're going to come here. I haven't something we haven't seen yet. We're going to say sensing. And we're going to look for if touching. And we can click this down arrow and say mouse pointer. Then I can meow. And for sanity, I can wait a couple seconds. OK, so let's say we run this. So I'm going to run this program. OK, it's running, but nothing happened. How come? So anyone else have any ideas? Yeah, so a couple different ideas. So what are some of the ideas again? Yeah, so that's the right idea. So we have, you know, this condition is attached to the cat. So we are going to say if the cat is touching the mouse pointer. But you're kind of getting at it. What happened?
I don't think it knows
So in this case, Scratch actually does. Scratch actually handles that for us. Because we're attaching these scripts to the cat, this if touching mouse pointer, Scratch just says if the cat is touching the mouse pointer. So yeah, this is just kind of done automatically. But what else are we missing? So let's say you're a computer. Run this program. So the green flag is clicked. I'm going to say, if I'm touching the cat, I'm not, then what? Game over, right? Our program runs, and then we're done. So how can we fix that? We're only checking this one. We're checking one time. Am I checking the mouse pointer? Nope. Then my program is done executing.
Because when you click the green flag, your mouse isn't on the cat.
Yes, exactly. So when I click the green flag, well, I'm just going to check one time. Nope, it's not on there. So my program's going to finish. So what do I need to change about this program to get it to do what we want? Yeah, so there we go. So we want to check every couple of seconds with a loop. Exactly. So if we take this block here and we put it inside of a forever loop. Okay, now I'm a computer. Let's try stepping through this program. So the first thing we hit is this forever. So say, okay, here comes a loop. So I'm a computer. I'm going to say, am I touching the mouse pointer? No, I'm not. So rather than just finishing, what this little arrow tells me is I'm going to jump back up to my condition. And so this means that I'm going to check over and over and over again, am I touching the mouse pointer? So we kind of fixed our problem. Our problem last time was that we only checked one time. But now I'm going to check a bunch of times. So if I click this green arrow, or flag, you can see here that on the left, this whole thing is outlined in white. And so in Scratch, this just means that this block is currently running. So I don't know if you noticed, but before we had that forever loop, it just kind of flashed white. That's because it just ran once and then it finished. But now it looks like it's continuing to run because this forever loop keeps happening. So now, we kind of get the effect we're looking for because we're continuously checking over and over again, am I touching the cat, yes or no? And so that's one instance in which a forever loop is actually what we're looking for. So let's try doing something else. So let's modify this a little bit. And so let's say that, you know, this is nice, but now we have a cat that isn't so nice. And rather than meowing when I pet it, we want it to do something else, like roar, for example. And if I'm not touching the cat, then that's when I want it to meow. So given the same basic structure, how can we make that modification that says, if I'm touching the cat, then I want you to roar. If I'm not touching the cat, then I want you to meow. What do we need to do to this program? Yeah. Yeah, so the if else, exactly. So let's throw this away. And so now let's use this thing here. So this allows us to kind of have two branches. If something is true, then okay. Else, then we'll do something else. So what do I want to put inside of this condition here? Yeah, so that same thing. We want to go to sensing and check to see if we're touching the mouse pointer. So sensing, touching, mouse pointer. So okay, so what's the last thing I need to do? Yeah, so where do I put the sounds now? Which sound should go where?
So
the roar should go at the top because we just arbitrarily said, okay, or we don't have the sound, so let me just pull up the one with the sound. So we want something like this. So if I'm touching the mouse pointer, then I just have this sound that I found online, and we're going to say, I want you to roar. And if not, then I want you to meow. So you can see here that this is this kind of branching. If this first thing is true, then we're going to play the sound, and if not, we're going to do something else. Yeah, question? Yeah, so let's see how we can combine these expressions. That's a great question. So let's say, we want it, rather than just saying if this one thing, we'll say if this one thing and this other thing. So if we come up here to the green, inside of operators, we have this thing here, this and. So let's take out this blue for a minute and plug in this green. So now we could say something like if I'm touching the mouse pointer, and we'll pick something else, and the space key is pressed. So now we've created a more complex condition. We've combined two different Boolean expressions into this one larger expression. So now we're saying, if my cursor is on the cat and my space key is pressed, only then will I play the lion sound. So if I come back over here to the green flag, we're meowing. If I put my mouse pointer on the cat, both of these conditions aren't satisfied. Only one of them is, so this whole thing is not, because they're both not true. But now if I hit the space bar, then we get something else. So we can see here that in order, before we ended up playing that lion noise, both of these things had to be true. That's because we hit this and. So how could I change this to say if I'm touching the cat or I hit the space bar? Kind of give the answer away, but how would I change this? Yeah, exactly. So in addition to the and, we have this thing called an or. So in over in operators, we have or. We also have this thing not. So we could say if I'm not touching the cat, which is kind of the same exact thing of putting it underneath the else in this case. So any questions on this program? OK, so let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back to some more advanced concepts in programming. All right, welcome back. So let's continue looking at some things we can do with this programming language called Scratch. So the next thing we're going to take a look at are these things called variables. So if you remember from high school algebra, these were the x's and the y's they had to solve for or find, and it was kind of annoying. But in programming, these are really, really helpful. So a variable is basically just some placeholder for a value. So something you can store some type of information. So we might want to store a number, we might want to store a word. And we can store it inside of a variable that we can use later. So here's an example in Scratch. So let's say I'm writing a Scratch program to help me get dressed in the morning. So I might want to have a variable called socks on feet. This keeps track of how many socks I'm currently wearing. So in Scratch, if I want to say I'm not wearing any socks, I'm going to set this variable equal to 0. So later on, I can say, what is the current value of this variable called socks on feet? I can later change it to 1 or change it to 2. But using these variables, I can keep track of the state of the world. You know, how close to being dressed am I? So let's take a look at how we might use variables inside of our Scratch program. So let's say that we want to make our cat count to 10. So starting from 1 to 10, how might we use a variable here? First, what's a variable we might want to create? Yeah, exactly. So we want to keep track of the current count. So we want to count from 1 to 10. So what that really means is if we have some variable called counter or something, we'll start that variable off at 1. Then if we say, OK, I want counter to go up by 1, then suddenly counter will be 2, counter will be 3, and eventually we'll reach 10, and that's how we can kind of count to 10. So let's see how we might do that in Scratch. So we haven't clicked here yet, but if we click on variables over here, let's click on make a variable. We're going to call this variable counter. So I click counter, and I click OK. So now I just got a whole bunch of blocks over here that didn't exist before. And so you'll notice that all of these blocks here have to do with the variable I just created called counter. So let's start off by saying I want the value of counter to be 1, since I want to count from 1 to some number. Question first? Yeah, exactly. So we just picked this variable here, and we called it counter. This name doesn't actually mean anything in Scratch. It's just something I picked. You know, I could have called this E1 if I wanted to. And later, you know, the computer also doesn't know that, OK, because this thing is called counter, I need to learn how to count upwards. We're going to have to manually say, move counter up by 1 or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, so this is just something Scratch did for me. When I clicked on make a variable, Scratch just said, OK, you just called a variable counter, and so then I just generated these blocks over here. So if we had more variables, we could have this drop-down menu, and we can access all the variables we create there. But we'll just be using one for now. So we'll just be working with this counter. Okay, so let's use, what are we probably going to need then? What's next in my counting program here? What's that?
Wait a second.
Yeah, so we could wait a minute. So then what we'll do after that? Yeah, okay, so let's do that. So let's say, okay, let's have wait 1 second. And then we want to change the counter by one. So if the counter was one, now it's going to be two. So what should I do now? Yeah, so I could do one of two things. So first, you know, I could say, wait 1 second, then change counter by one again. Yeah, so let's use a loop. So exactly, so I could keep going over and over again, kind of, you know, wait, change, or I could put this inside of a loop. So let's just do a simple loop first. Let's say this forever loop over here. So let's put this over here and put this inside of it. And I just threw away the wrong one. So this is exactly what we had before. We're going to wait 1 second, and then we're going to change the counter by one. So this means we're just going to add one to the counter. So notice how changing by one is different than setting to one. When I say change by one, it goes from one to two, two to three, and so on. So OK, great. So now let's see what happens when I run this. So when I created the variable, Scratch also put this thing up here in the top left corner. And that's just kind of letting you know what the value of the variable is. So if I want to get rid of that, if I just check on this checkbox here, it'll go away. But let's leave it there for a second. And now let's click on the green flag. So 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And so now notice that suddenly we're counting up to 10. So let's say now that instead of simply displaying this variable up here, let's say that we want the cat to actually say, you know, say out loud, or not literally, but display that little speech bubble with the current counter. How might I do that? What should I drag? What puzzle piece should I drag in? So we don't need the and operator, since we just need to do one thing. We just need to say, I want you to say this. So what block did we see before that would allow the cat to say something? Yeah, so over here in this purple, this looks. Remember before when we said hello to Ben and RJ? So if we do this, this isn't that helpful. We're just going to say hello over and over again. But what we can actually do is rather than just saying hello, I want to actually say the value of this counter. So if I drag and drop this into there, kind of tricky, now what's going to happen is the cat is going to say, what is the current value of my counter variable? Okay, it's going to start off being one. I'm going to say that out loud in the little speech bubble. So then later, when we change the counter by one, I'm going to use that new value. So what is going to happen when I run this program as it is right here? What are the first three things the cat is going to say? OK, so 1, 2, 3. Anyone else disagree or have something different? Yeah, so we have 2, 3, 4. So what happened? Let's pretend I'm a computer, and let's run through this. So as you know, you're writing your Scratch programs. You know, you can't figure out what you need to do or something's not working right. This is kind of the process you want to go through. Pretend I'm a computer, and step by step, do exactly what the computer would do. So OK, I'm the cat. I set my counter to 1. So I'm remembering the value of this variable is 1. All right. So now I'm entering into this forever loop. So that means only what's inside of here is going to run over and over again. So OK, I'm going to wait 1 second. Nothing happened there. Now I'm going to change my counter by 1. So it just went from a 1 to a 2. So now I'm going to say out loud the number 2. So I come up. That's the end of my forever loop. So I jump back up here. I'm going to wait 1 second, change it by 1. And then I'm going to say 3, exactly. So if I hit the green flag, we can see that what the cat is going to do kind of exactly what we just said. So wait, say 3. Wait, say 4. OK, so let's say, you know, instead of counting starting at 2, I want to start at 1. There are two ways that I can fix this. What's one of them? Yeah, so 1. Let's rather than counting at 1, let's try counting at 0. So that means that the first time I change it, it will change from 0 to 1. So if I click the green flag, it will start counting at 1. Okay, so that's one way to fix it. So let's put this back to 1. And what's another way I can fix this program?
Save before the change.
Yeah, exactly. So I can just move the position of this say to here, for example. Now again, if I run this, we're going to say 1, 2, 3. So any questions on this program? Yeah?
Just to simply clarify.
Sure.
Variables are placeholders for numbers, right? Is that?
Yeah, so a variable kind of holds some number, and then when I access that variable, this counter, it won't actually say counter. It's kind of a placeholder for some other value. So consider a variable kind of as some container for a value, maybe a better word. Yeah, so this is true for programming in general. You know, a variable is just some container for some value. Exactly. Okay, so let's modify this a little bit. Let's say rather than starting at 1, I want to start from a random number. How could I do that? What's a small change I need to make? So we saw before, I have this block that will pick a random number. So we have pick random 1 to 10. Where should I put that? Exactly. So I don't want to set the counter to 1. Now I want to set the counter to some random variable. So if I just drop that in now and click the green flag, I start counting at some random number. So again, this is just kind of using the blocks that we've seen to kind of create different programs. So any questions on how this one works? Okay, so let's take a look at some other things Scratch can do. So that single variable was nice. And the thing with the variable, this was kind of a container for one single value. But instead of just containing a value, maybe you want to contain some list of values. So in Scratch, and programming in general, this is called an array. So an array, rather than just being a single item, might be a list of items. So we'll see in a moment how we could use an array. But here, we can say I have some list. It's called inventory. Maybe I'm playing an RPG or a first-person shooter. And I want to add something to my inventory. So my inventory is just this list of items. So to add something to that list, I can say add, you know, this string here, this thing, to that list of items. So let's look at an example of that. Maybe. Okay. So we have a number of past projects here that we can showcase. And so this is one of them. So this was called Fruitcraft. And Fruitcraft is basically the point of this game is you walk around and you collect fruit, and then you deliver all the fruit to the fruit place. But the way that this works is that we're representing our inventory as this big list. So as I walk around collecting fruit, I'm going to continually add that fruit to my inventory. So for example, let's actually run this first to get an idea of how this works. So we have a nice animation to start. Okay, so we walk around. Okay, so now we have a bunch of different fruit over here on the ground. So each of these fruit is actually a different sprite. So the examples we've seen so far is just kind of a single cat, and he's sitting there, and he's one sprite, and we manipulated what the cat did. So we can also add sprites over here with this new sprite button. So for example, if we click on this one here, create new sprite from file, it can actually open up any different image we want, and Scratch comes with a lot of different animals and different images you might want to use in your program. So that's nice. So this person has created a bunch of different sprites here, and each one happens to have a different image, and that's, you know, we just saw how we can choose an image there. So if we click on one of these sprites, we can see here now the scripts that are associated with this sprite. So we just had one sprite, you know, all of the scripts were just, they pertain to that single sprite. But now that we have more than one thing on the screen, we can have scripts associated with each of these different things. So these are the scripts that are only associated with this sprite here. So we'll see what this thing here, when I receive, we'll see that in a moment. But the line that matters here is add bananas to inventory. So that means as soon as this character here, as soon as the character touches this sprite here, what it's going to do is it's going to add bananas to his list of items that he's carrying. So if we go back to the game and I walk into the cherries, for example, we can see here that this is the list of things that I'm carrying. And because I walked into cherries, somewhere in cherries, it said, when I touch the hero, I'm going to add myself to this list of items. So I can continue walking around, pick up the orange, and notice that, you know, everything is going to do the exact same thing. It's just going to add itself to my list. And if I walk into the fruit place, we can then kind of rattle off what everything was. So to do that, you know, rather than just saying a variable, we can also put in this entire array here and say everything that's inside of the list. So then we get this nice fruit platter from the fruit place. So any questions on how arrays work? Yeah. Of course.
But, you know, it runs into, you know, runs into the things, and then is it kind of the same type of programming?
Yeah. So this is. You know what I mean? Yeah. So this is really similar to how you might make Pac-Man, for example. So if I jump back, and I click on this guy here. So you'll notice here how we kind of have this big sequence of ifs and else. If the left key is pressed, if the down key is pressed, if the right key is pressed, and this is how we're kind of simulating moving him around. And so, you know, the programmers of Pac-Man probably have something similar. You know, if the joystick is left, then make him go left. If the joystick is right, you know, do something like that. And so these are kind of the basic building blocks you can start to make some nicer looking games. Yeah.
That's what I was just wondering, is it the same type of like arrays? You know what I mean?
Sure. So I don't know actually, you know, what how Pac-Man is actually implemented, but you know, they might have arrays that represent how many dots have been eaten, or you know, RJ might know. For example, he knows more about old video games than I do. Yeah?
That thing that we just saw,
Yeah, exactly. So if we jump back to this game, you know, this is really not too dissimilar to any other program you might run in your computer. And so, yeah, so this could be some kind of user interface. You know, the user interface says to move around, use the arrows. That makes sense. In the interface, we have this thing in the top left showing what we currently have. So exactly, and we can see now that we've done things like critiqued interfaces and said, you know, this interface is bad because. And so now what we're doing is we're taking a look at underneath the hood what's actually going on with some computer programs. And so things like Microsoft Word aren't written in Scratch, but they're written in something that has the same exact underlying concepts with these ifs and elses and loops. So yeah, so you could consider this, you know, to be a user interface for some program. This program just happens to be a game. Okay. So a couple other things going on in Scratch. So when we have multiple sprites on the screen, it turns out that we can do multiple things at once. So this is called, in computers, this is called something called threads. Terrible sentence. So what a thread is basically when you have two things going on at the same time. So if you have multiple characters moving around on the screen, each of those characters might be what's called a single thread. And so now if you have multiple threads going on in your program, you can have more than one thing occurring at once. So let's take a look at an example. So if we come down here to threads, okay, so here is a bit of a simpler program this time. Now we have two sprites. And the idea behind this program is we want the cat to chase the bird until eventually they'll collide and the cat will win. So the cat and the bird are going to be moving around at the same time. But we don't want to have to say, you know, the bird's going to move and then we'll wait for him to finish and then the cat will start moving, because that's just going to be a kind of a boring program. Instead, what we want is for two things to go on at the same time. So if I click the green flag, you know, this is kind of the effect that we can get with two things happening at once. And this is kind of like watching the screensaver on a DVD menu. You're like waiting for the thing to hit the corner. Okay, so eventually he's going to catch the bird. So how did we do that? So to do that, the first thing we did was we created two sprites. You notice here that the scripts for this sprite are different than the scripts for this sprite. So, you know, at a high level, the bird is just going to kind of jump to some position, point in a direction, and do something forever. No, it's just going to keep moving three steps, and if it hits the edge, we saw it's just going to kind of bounce around. So while this is occurring, the cat is also chasing the bird. So we click on the cat, and the cat, again, is just going to do something like aim towards the bird and move towards it one step. So eventually it's going to catch it. But these things now are occurring at the exact same time. And so we've launched what's called a separate thread for each of these two things. A cat has its own thread that's executing, and the bird has its own thread that is executing at the same time. So this is kind of like the parallelism we saw a little bit earlier in the course. Okay. So another Scratch concept. So something called events. So an event is something that happens within your program. So now if I'm using Google Chrome, an event might be hitting the refresh button or hitting the home button. When I click on refresh, I want my program to respond somehow. But I don't really want to sit there and say, OK, is the mouse touching the refresh button? Is there a mouse touching the refresh button? And kind of have a loop, because that's just going to end up sitting there and not really allow me to do anything else. So what I instead want is a different way of expressing this same thing. What I want to say is, OK, when I click on that refresh button, it's going to tell everyone else in the program, hey, the person just clicked on the refresh button. You should do something. So what happens then is this thing is called an event. So let's jump back to Scratch, and let's just create a new program here. So we have a cat here, and I want to add another cat or another animal. So if I click down here on New Sprite, let's just add this crazy looking butterfly, and we'll put him over here. So what I want now is I want the cat to be able to talk to the butterfly. So what I want to happen is I want the cat to say something, and then I want the butterfly to respond only when the cat has said something. So what I want to avoid here is some kind of loop on the butterfly that says, did the cat say this? Did the cat say this? Did the cat say this? Instead, I'm going to define some event that says, when the cat says something, broadcast some event. Let everyone else know that something has just happened. And then the butterfly can respond to that event. So let's start off with the cat. So the first thing we want is this green flag clicked, just because we always want some starting point for our program. So what I want to do is I want to say, when I press the space bar, that's when the cat is going to broadcast some event. So I'm going to have some forever loop. And just like we did before, I'm going to check if the space bar is pressed. So I'll drag over an if, come up here to sensing, and I'll say if the space bar is pressed. So then I'll come over here, and I'll say hello. And so now this is just going to have the effect of the cat's going to sit there, and when I press the space bar, it's going to say hello. So now what I want is some way of informing this other sprite that this event has occurred. So if I come back up here to control and scroll down a bit, we have this thing here called broadcast. And this is where I'm going to broadcast that some event has occurred. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to drag this over here. And right now, I don't have any events defined yet. I just started off a new program. You know, I haven't set any events. So if I click here and say new, I'll just say something like, hello. OK. So what I just did was the cat is going to say hello for 2 seconds. Then it's going to tell everyone else in the world, hey, this event just occurred. This event hello has happened. So if you want to respond to it, then you can. OK, so let's come over to the butterfly now. And so now we don't want the butterfly to do something when the green flag is clicked. Instead, what we want to do is respond to that event. So if I scroll down a bit, I have this when I receive. So let's drag this over. So this says that some other sprite is going to broadcast this message and trigger this event called hello. And when this event happens, that's when I can respond to it. So if I come over here and I just say hello, so when I click this green flag, what's going to happen? So let's recap. The butterfly is not going to do anything, because the butterfly is going to wait for this event called hello. The cat now is going to say, OK, let's check if the space key is pressed. If it is, say hello and broadcast this event. So I click the green flag. Nothing happens. I click the space bar. The cat says hello for 2 seconds. And then the butterfly responds, because we've created this event that the butterfly responds to. So by the way, we could also say something like this. So rather than having this loop that's going to execute forever, we can just say, well, it also happens to be an event when some key is pressed that we can respond to. So now this will do the exact same thing. If I just click this and run this, you know, we'll get the same effect. We click the green flag, nothing happens. We press the space bar, that triggers this event to everyone, and we get the same exact thing. So any questions there on events? Okay. So let's take a look at some other examples of past projects that are pretty fun. So has anyone here played Frogger? Does anyone here consider themselves good enough at Frogger to play right now? Is anyone bad enough at Frogger? Yeah, if you want to play Frogger. Okay, so this is actually a past project from a couple years ago. Someone took the time to make Frogger in Scratch. So what's your name?
Sam.
Okay, so you know the controls of Frogger, just kind of arrow keys left and right? Yep. So if I click this button here, we can actually play Frogger in Scratch. So I think if you click the green flag again, it'll restart. There you go. And there you go. So great job. And so this is just, you know, one example of something that you can create in Scratch. So if we look at, you know, the sprites, you know, it gets pretty crazy. We have a sprite for every single lily pad, and, you know, we have a bunch of different scripts here. But really, you know, we haven't done anything else. We're using these same exact puzzle pieces to create something that's really, really cool. So let's take a look at another really fun Scratch project. So how about Dance Dance Revolution? Anyone ever played that? So does anyone want to try their hand at Scratch Scratch Revolution? You don't actually have to dance, it's just the arrow keys. We're not at that technology yet. Yeah, go ahead. So this takes a little bit to load. Okay. So here we go. Press space to begin, and then you'll press the arrow keys once they hit that top layer there.
Work it, make it, do it. Makes us all the better, faster, stronger. Work it, nah, nah, harder, that, that don't kill me. Can faster, only make us stronger. I need you to hurry up, man. Cause I can't wait much longer. I know I got to be right now. Cause I can't get much stronger. That's how long I've been on ya. You know how long I've been on ya. Since Princess on Apollonia. Since OJ had isotoners. Don't act like I never told ya. You know how long I've been on ya. Since Princess on Apollonia. Since OJ had isotoners. Don't act like I never told ya.
Never told ya. Never told ya. Never told ya.
So these are just some of the different games that you can create, all just using Scratch. So again, this, you know, ends up being pretty crazy in terms of, you know, how many sprites you have. We can really create some awesome games just using these little puzzle pieces.
So are these created by importing images and music and stuff?
Yeah, exactly. So if you come over here to new sprite, so you don't just have to use the sprites that they give you. You can actually, you know, just pick any file in your computer and then you can pull it in. Same things with sounds. You can also import a sound, and you know, they give you a bunch of built-in ones, but if you have music or something, you can play that there. So in addition to games, you can also make animations in Scratch. And so here's one past animation, the dance meter ready to go. Projects, you know, you don't have to just do a game. You know, feel free to have something that the user can just sit back and enjoy. So, any last questions on Scratch? Yeah. So you'll get lots of practice using Scratch on this week's problem set. You know, you just get to make something kind of fun that you can show off to your friends. Just a quick note on Scratch. You know, we saw this website. You know, Scratch actually allows you to upload your file, so you can give someone a URL and they can use the game you made or the animation you made in the web browser. And so that's really, really cool, too. So if there are no more questions on Scratch, so just the last thing we'll do today is just kind of look at a real programming language, per se. When I say real, you know, Scratch is no less real than any other programming language. We just saw we can create some pretty amazing games and programs in it. But this other programming language called JavaScript is one you may have heard of, and it's one that's usually commonly used on web browsers. So kind of making some interactive websites, code that is actually executed by your web browser rather than being executed by Scratch. And this is something that's really widely used out in the real world. But the thing is here is that the same exact concepts we just saw, things like variables and conditions and loops, they're exactly the same inside of JavaScript, this programming language that's powering things like Facebook and Google and, you know, all the other websites out there. It's the same exact concepts, they're just kind of presented a little bit differently. Namely, you don't have puzzle pieces, you just have to type stuff. So the way that we're going to get JavaScript onto the page is with this element here, the script tag. So inside of a script tag, rather than writing HTML or CSS, we can actually now type in some JavaScript, the typing equivalent of those puzzle pieces. So let's translate some things in Scratch to JavaScript. So this was the first Scratch statement we saw over here, this block. And this was just some way of making a character say something to the user. So the way that we express this exact same thing in JavaScript looks a little bit more cryptic, but it's still pretty understandable. So we can see here that this oh hi world, this message, this looks like it's the same thing here, this oh hi world. And so rather than saying this say, in JavaScript, rather than saying say, we just say alert. And so what this will do is if we actually run this JavaScript code, we'll display a little pop-up to the user in a web browser. And the contents of that pop-up will be oh hi world. And so you can see here that it looks pretty similar. You know, we have what we're going to do, then something, and then inside of this white box here, what we're going to say. And in JavaScript, again, we just say alert, what we're going to do. We have some parentheses, and inside of those parentheses is what we actually want to say. So here's another example. So here's how we created a variable in Scratch. We have this red block here that said set socks on feet to 0. So in JavaScript, again, we're going to need to type this out somehow. And the way we can do that is this keyword here, var. That's just short for a variable, because I'm creating a new variable. Then I have the name of my variable. It's still socks on feet. That's exactly the same. And then over here, we're saying I want that to be equal to 0. And so now, in JavaScript land, I have this new variable. It's called socks on feet. and I've set it equal to 0. Okay, so let's look at a condition now. So in Scratch, we had this block here. We had if something, else something. In JavaScript, we just have something that looks a little bit more cryptic, but it's still, you know, the same shape and structure at least. So we have the word if. Then inside of here, we have the equivalent of this area here. We have some Boolean expression. And our Boolean expression this time says that if the value of this variable is equal to 2, then I want to display a pop-up that says done. And if it's not true, so if this variable has some other value, then I want to display a different pop-up. So just as a side note, the reason we have these two equal signs here to say is this equal to 2 is just because the single equal sign was already taken. So again, this is just some different way of representing this programming concept. Rather than using a puzzle piece, we have some text. So how about loops? So we saw in Scratch that we can loop forever, or we can loop something like 10 times. So when we created that counting application, we counted from 1 to whenever we felt like clicking the red button. We created this variable called counter. And then at every run through of the loop, we changed that counter by 1. We incremented it or added 1 to it. So we can do the same thing in JavaScript. So this is a little bit longer, but it's kind of the same exact flow. With this line here, we're creating a new variable called counter, and we're setting that variable to 0. So that's just like the red block we saw before. So now we have a loop. And the first type of loop in JavaScript is called a while loop. So we're going to say while some Boolean expression is true, then I want to keep running this block over and over again. So here, again, is that same Boolean expression. While the value of counter is less than the number 10, then I want to keep running this loop. So this thing here, counter is less than 10, that's going to be either true or false, because either this variable is less than 10 or it's not. So this thing here is going to be true or false. And if it is true, then that's when we want to execute these two things here. So notice how we're using curly braces, so one here and one down here, to kind of demarcate what we want to be run over and over again inside of the loop. And so now, inside of the loop, this is exactly what we did before. We want to say the value of the variable out loud, so alert instead of say. This will just display a pop-up with whatever number we're currently on. So after that, we want to change the counter by 1. So we can't just say change counter by 1 in this programming language. It just works a little bit differently. So we're instead going to say something like this. So I want to change the value of this counter. So what do I want to set that to? Well, I want that value to be whatever the value was previously plus 1. So if it was a 3, for example, then I want to say that it's 3 plus 1 or 4. So by saying this here, if the counter is currently 3, then this here is going to be 3, and I add 1, so this whole right-hand side here is a 4 now, and I'm going to say, okay, then the new value of counter is 4. So when I run through this loop, I'm going to get the same kind of pattern that I got the last time. I'm going to start this variable off at 0. I'm going to display the value 0. I'm going to change the value to be 1. I'm going to come back up here to the start of my loop, and I'm going to say, well, is 1 less than 10? No, it's not. So execute this, then run this. Now it's going to be a 2. Is 2 less than 10? No, and so on and so forth. So eventually, through this process of adding 1 to counter, my counter is going to be more than 10. And so that's when this loop is going to stop running. I'm going to break out of this and do something else. So this last line here, turns out that we can actually just express this a little bit more concisely. So if you see somewhere this counter plus plus, that's just short for counter equals counter plus 1. So it turns out that we can shorten this even further. You know, the same idea of just creating some counting variable, creating some condition at which the loop is going to stop running, and then changing the value of the variable. We can shorten it to this thing here. So this is called a for loop. It looks a bit more complicated than that while loop, but it's doing the exact same thing. So this first part here, this var I equals 0. So we saw before that when I say var I equals 0, that means I'm creating a new variable. And rather than calling it counter, just to save space on the screen, I've just called this I. So that means after this thing is run, I have a new variable, it's called I, and it has a value of 0. So then we're going to have a semicolon, because we're going to have the kind of three parts inside of these parentheses. So the next part is exactly what we just saw, some condition, some Boolean expression that has to be true in order for the loop to run over and over again. So now, you know, this is the same thing as before. I is 0, that's going to be less than 10, so we're going to run. So finally, this third part here is going to be what we want to do after the loop has finished running. So we saw before, what is this I++? What is that short for? Yeah, exactly. So this is just like I equals I plus 1. And so then this same loop is going to do exactly the same thing. We're going to alert 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So any questions on how we're kind of translating this? We started off with some puzzle pieces, and now we're just kind of switching from puzzle pieces to some text. Yeah.
Was Scratch based on Java?
Yeah, so was Scratch based on Java? So Scratch, I'm actually not sure what language Scratch is written in. So there are a bunch of different programming languages. So JavaScript is just one of them. You know, things like Java, which is actually different than JavaScript, kind of confusingly, Java is one thing and JavaScript is this newer thing that works in web browsers. You know, other languages include C or C++ or C Sharp or Python or Ruby, if you've ever heard any of these words. These are just basically different ways of expressing the same thing. So in Python, for example, or any other programming language, you know, rather than saying for var I equals 0, you know, I might say something like, you know, for just I equals 0, and that I++, you know, just changes to some other way of typing it. So whether or not Scratch is based on Java, it might be. You know, what happens when you create those puzzle pieces, Scratch might translate that kind of behind the hood into some other programming language, whether that be Java or something else. And then, because your computer already knows how to run Java code, for example, then if we translate these kind of Scratch puzzle pieces to Java code, then your computer can then run the Java code and kind of get the program that you're looking for. So I think it's based on something like that, but I'm actually not positive for sure. So let's take a look at an example of a JavaScript program. So here we just have some big HTML file. So we saw these in last lecture, you know, what's going on here. But this script element now means that what I'm about to type is going to be some JavaScript. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to create some variable, this var socks equals 2. And then I have this condition. I say if socks has a value of 2, I'm going to do this, else I'm going to do this. So what's going to happen if I visit this web page? Yeah, exactly. So if I open this HTML file up in the browser, this thing here, yeah, so I just get this pop-up here that says I have 2 socks. And if I, just to make sure, if I did this, what would happen? So we'll get this pop-up here. This will no longer be true, and I'll get this pop-up here, and I'll be sad. So that's kind of boring. So let's take a look at a more interesting JavaScript program. Shouldn't have quit that. So let's try this one here. So this is the JavaScript program that I am definitely going to use to assign all the final grades. So don't worry about this thing here. Let's just focus on this part here. So I have this variable called score. And what am I doing here? Saying, OK, well, if the score is greater than some value, then I'm going to say you get an A. If the score is greater than 80, I'm going to say you get a B, and so on. So any questions on how, you know, we're using these conditions in JavaScript? OK, so let's talk about kind of what's going on around here. So what's nice about JavaScript is that it allows us to actually manipulate what's going on a web page. So you know, you'll notice, you know, it's something like Google Instant. You know, as you're typing, you'll notice that the page responds to your key presses. You know, in Google, they decided that, you know, it is so time-consuming to have to click search or press enter that you no longer have to do that. Just, you know, once you finish typing, your search results are there. So that means that somehow some code is running that's going to run your search for you, you know, without you having to do anything. And so the way Google implemented that was with JavaScript. So we have some JavaScript code that's going to manipulate what's going on in the web browser. So the way we manipulate it is we're going to manipulate this thing called the DOM. This stands for the Document Object Model. But basically, when your browser downloads an HTML page, you know, that might look something like this. You know, we saw this last lecture. When your browser downloads this, It needs to display it somehow. And that means in order to display it, we need to load it into memory. So we talked about RAM. We said that, you know, something we might store in RAM is, you know, what page your web browser is at. So when we store this in RAM, what we'd really like to do is somehow capture this hierarchy. So remember that we said that this head is a child of this HTML element, which has this child called title. Then, you know, we have some more hierarchy here. And so what we'd like to do is kind of represent that hierarchy somehow. And the way that your web browser is going to do this, actually model this HTML page, is with something called a tree. So let's say that we want to capture this same hierarchy. So we're going to create a tree. So we're going to start our tree off at the top here with this HTML element. Because remember, this was kind of the first element inside of our HTML here, and everything else is contained within this HTML tag. So underneath that, HTML has two children. So we have a head, remember, and a body. And both of these tags are directly underneath this HTML tag. And so the head has its own child called title, and the body has its own children. You know, we have a heading and we have a span. And so this tree here is how your browser might actually represent this HTML file in memory. So rather than, you know, just look, once we have the response from the server, that's this HTML text, your browser is going to go through all of that text and kind of construct this tree so that it can easily be manipulated and, you know, we can change what the web page looks like. So once we have this tree, what we really want to be able to do is manipulate it. You know, we want to get at some of the elements inside of this tree. So we saw last week that we had this attribute called the ID attribute. And it was really nice for CSS because it basically allowed us to say, I want to just access this one thing and I want to access it right away. So in JavaScript, we're going to have the same idea. You know, let's say that we want to get the value of, you know, a form. We allow the user to type in their name, and we want to access what they typed in. So the first thing we need to do is we need to somehow get at that input element, that text box. So the way we can do that is we know that because this entire HTML file is going to be loaded into memory and located inside of this big tree thing, that means somewhere in this tree has to be some element that represents my text box. So what I want to do then is just kind of find that element inside of this big tree, then I want to get at its value. So if I come back over here to the laptop, let's open up input.html. So we can see here that, let me just pull this down so we can see it. So we have a really simple HTML page. We have this element here called input. And we haven't seen this yet, but the input element just creates a little tiny text box on my page. I know it's a text box because I specified this other attribute here that said what type of input is it? Well, it's a text box. So underneath that, I then have a button. So this button also has a unique ID. So because I have this unique IDs, that means it's going to be really simple for me to access these elements. So to do that, I can use this special thing in JavaScript called getElementById. And what that's going to do is it's going to say, okay, I have this big DOM tree. It's got a bunch of stuff in it. What I want to do is I'm only concerned about one thing. And the one thing that I'm concerned about is the element with the ID submit. So what am I going to get back when I call this document.getElementById submit? What is the browser going to give me back? Yeah, so let's look first. So we have this thing here, this ID name and ID submit. So am I going to get back the input or am I going to get back the button? Yeah, so I'm going to get back the button because I'm asking for the submit ID. So that's going to give me back a button. So then what I want to do is I want to say, okay, when this button is pressed, then I want to react to that. So how did we do that in Scratch? How did we kind of react to things that were going on? What did we add? So we broadcasted something. What was that thing we broadcasted? What was that called? Yeah, so we called that an event. So some event occurred, and we want to respond to that. So we're going to do the same thing in JavaScript. So we have different events that can occur inside of the web browser. So one of those events, you know, could be this click. And so anyway, don't worry too much about the syntax. You know, you won't be asked to like write out all the syntax. Just kind of looking at the general ideas. We have some event that's going to occur in the web browser, you know, some click. So that means that we're going to want to say, when the submit button is actually clicked, some event occurs, then we can respond to that. So the way that we can respond to that is with this thing here. We can have some pop-up. We want inside of the pop-up, we want to display what it is that the user typed in. So that means that rather than getting the submit element now, we now want to get this input element. So to do that, rather than getting by the ID submit, we're going to say, I want the ID name. And so this is just going to be now a different element on the page. So now this is going to give us back this input thing here, and then we can access what the user actually typed in. So again, don't worry too much about the syntax or what, you know, is actually the what you actually have to type out. But the general idea here is that we're using the same exact things we used in Scratch. We have some event that's going to occur on the web browser, and we can respond to that event by kind of accessing some more things in the DOM, or this big tree. So if I visit this HTML page, for example, this input. So here's our text box. And if I just type in the word hello and click submit, I get this pop-up here that says hello. And that's because I just triggered that event. And through JavaScript, I said, OK, when this event occurs, I want to display a pop-up. So any questions there? Yeah. Yeah, so let's jump back. So this click here, this is some event that has already been defined for me. So much like in Scratch, we had that event for like when spacebar is pressed. Now that was some event that was already created for me. So in the web browser, this click event was already created for me. And so here, I'm just saying when I receive a click, then I want to do something. And so that's why we didn't have to like create this click event somewhere else. It was already created for us. OK, so that was just kind of the basics of how JavaScript works. You know, if you want to use JavaScript in your final project, you know, feel free to read up about it a little bit more. And it can be great for adding a little bit of cool, snazzy effects to your web page that you create for your final project. But the point of that discussion was more that we can translate the concepts that we'll see in Scratch and the programs we'll actually write in Scratch. It's not too bad to actually translate those to something that would run in a more of a real-world situation, like a web browser or on your desktop somewhere. So don't worry too much if the syntax, what you have to type in JavaScript was a little bit crazy. So with that, I just want to give a big thanks to all of the course staff, Ben, RJ, also Chris, Dan, Ramon, and all of the production staff that have filmed all of our section videos, done all of the editing, getting the live stream up. That's a ton of work. It's been a lot of fun teaching this course. I hope you enjoyed it as well. We'll see you next week for the exam, and then the week after that, we'll have a fun movie night. We can hang out afterwards and go out to dinner or something if everybody wants. So with that, thanks so much for taking this course, and I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week.